It's really a toss-up whether painter Wayne Thiebaud is more in love with food or with color. His paintings of pies, cakes, donuts, gumball machines, scoops of ice cream are some of the most vivid and well-known canvases in American art. Sweet to look at, nostalgic, but more and more interesting the closer you look. This weekend, we wish Wayne Thiebaud a birthday cake as gorgeous and delicious as any he has ever painted, because on Sunday, November 15th, Wayne Thiebaud turns 100 years old. And his plan for the big day? To paint. Here he is talking to the Academy of Achievement in 2011, when he was a mere 91.
I don't like the term artist. It's a term which I'm uncomfortable with, but I love the idea of being a cartoonist, a draftsman, a designer, a painter. Those are things which we make clear, objective information about. The idea of being a fine artist came very, very late.
It may make Wayne Thiebaud uncomfortable to be called an artist, but it's going to be hard for me to avoid during this episode. His work is in the permanent collection of major museums. He's been awarded the National Medal of Arts. His 1962 painting, Four Pinball Machines, just sold at auction for $19 million. So, artist it is. You'll find his bold, whimsical palette and thick layers of paint elevating other everyday objects as well. Clowns, lipsticks, shoes, sardine cans. Then there are his streetscapes of San Francisco, his rural California landscapes, and his quiet portraits of people at the beach. Smithsonian Magazine once called Wayne Thiebaud the hardest working artist in America. But he always worked hard outside his studio as well, teaching art and art history for decades at University of California at Davis. One of his many young students who went on to great success was Fritz Scholder, who helped create the New Indian Art Movement. Mr. Scholder died in 2005, but spoke to the Academy several years before.
To be different for the sake of being different means nothing. You must walk that tightrope between accident and discipline. Accident by itself, so what? Discipline by itself is boring. By walking that tightrope and putting down something on a canvas that conceivably is unique in coming from your guts, you have a chance of making marks that, of course, will live longer than you.
So, a twofer on this episode, a conversation with Wayne Thiebaud and his masterful student, Fritz Scholder. I'm so happy to be talking about art. We could all stand to take a little moment for beauty and transcendence this week, don't you think? This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm your host, Alice Winkler.
Academy, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Wayne Thiebaud was born 100 years ago in Mesa, Arizona. But the family moved to Southern California, and when his father lost his job there during the Depression, they moved to Southern Utah to try ranching in a little town between St. George and Cedar City.
Sort of red earth country, very beautiful. Probably had a lot of influence on interest in landscapes. Very beautiful country in so many different ways.
They were Mormon and had a large extended family.
I was lucky to have a lot of good uncles. My grandmother gave birth to 11 children, and they all married, so we have a great range of people. Farmers, businessmen, traveling salesmen, fishermen, a huge, very nice range of differences.
But not an artist among them.
My father was a mechanic inventor and mother a homemaker. I was a spoiled child. They couldn't have been a greater psychological base to give me the kind of ego I have.
In what sense?
Just that I felt I could do anything I wanted.
A pretty handy confidence to have, though the downside, Tebow said, was that he didn't feel he needed to work hard in school, so he didn't. His intellectual life, his love of books, would come later in life. As a teenager, his focus was on sports, which, he told our interviewer Gail Eichenthal, would turn out to be vital to his life as a painter.
Lots to do with basketball early on. Almost all sports, baseball, softball, track and field, came to tennis very late. I don't think I must have been 40 years old before I ever played tennis. That's why I have such a rotten game.
You're still playing, of course.
Still playing, but it's a what you call a public courts game.
I'm not positive he's still playing at 100, but he definitely was into his 90s when this interview took place, and I read that he was at 98, so I wouldn't be surprised. Playing tennis and painting.
It's interesting that you're committed to, you know, exercise and sports even now. Do you think there's a relationship between body and art?
Very much so. Central. It's what Gloria Steinem identifies as the most revolutionary human emotion, that is empathy. And since the body is the measure of empathy, it's crucially central to a kind of critical concern about the inner workings of a painting. Its thrust, its spatial illusionism, the coherence with which we judge balance, symmetry, tension, grace, those are all based on the body, its feel, extremities, those kinds of things. Scale, absolutely. If you're not participating with your body when you're looking at a painting, whether it's a Cézanne, which has to do with a kind of equivocation, ambiguity, a sense of alternation, or in the case of someone like Velázquez, where the physical attributes of his painting, the knowledge that he's showing you and the feeling which he's expressing, that's all about the body. Whether it's sitting well, a state of tension, whether that heel really feels like it's gripping the ground or expressing that contact. All of those we measure really by, in my judgment, the body and its issues.
So Wayne Tebow has always felt his athleticism, his connection to his body, has been crucial to his art. But it's a sentiment many painters don't share.
That's why I have difficulty in convincing students to stand when they paint rather than sit, for instance. There's a real difference in the character of gesticulation and locations, things like that.
So when did his interest in art actually begin?
Well, it began really with cartoonists. George Harriman, the creator of Crazy Cat, an extraordinary man and extraordinary artist. When you use the term artist, then you're talking about the highest achievement within each of those categories.
Wayne Tebow doesn't have a lot of use for the categories. cartooning, sign painting, illustration, fine art. He has done them all. And although his paintings hang in museums now, he doesn't care for the hierarchy.
After all, I'm an old cartoonist and love cartoons. And critics don't realize when they talk about them as sort of cartoony, that that's a great compliment to me. I collect all those old guys and have a great admiration and love for them.
And the distinction between so-called fine artists and commercial artists? Not so clear.
After all, they're trained in the same school as the fine artists. And they're very, very good at what they do, and they're very artful in what they do. We still, I think, haven't got the categories fully straightened out about fine art and commercial art. We like to think we have, but I don't know. It's proven to be actually now that American illustrators of a certain quality are commanding very high prices all of a sudden because they're so damn special. And if the character of art doesn't contain the idea of specialness, rare achievement in a certain limited convention, then I think we've got it wrong. If we don't celebrate anything which makes and comes to these rare achievements.
When Tebow was still in high school, he spent a summer at Walt Disney Studios as an apprentice in the animation department, where he drew what are called in-betweens, the drawings that create the appearance of movement between the key images. He worked on Goofy, Pluto, and Jiminy Cricket.
I'm no fool, no siree. I want to live to be 93. I play safe for you and me, 'cause I'm no fool.
Another summer in high school, he studied at a trade school in Los Angeles, where they taught cooking and plumbing, carpentry and sign painting. It was called Frank Wiggum's Trade School, and he went there for the sign painting.
Well, it just showed you very practical ways to do things. How to put a hat on a head. How to find the sole of a shoe and build a shoe up from that. Or to think about advertising posters and all of its consequences. Very exciting stuff. And I just wanted to be a red-hot advertising art director from then on.
Tebow went to work for a number of advertising agencies in California and then New York. By that time, he was learning everything he could about the world's great painters, but he still didn't aspire to become one of them. Then he met Robert Mallory.
He was pursuing fine art, even though he was working as a commercial artist. And he's the first one who showed me how dumb I was. As I expressed an interest in fine art at that time, because I'd been going to museums, he really gave me my first serious critical confrontation with how hard you had to work, how you had not to expect much, because you were dealing with a tradition which was an extraordinary community of excellence. So you prepared yourself, and you should say to yourself, I'm lucky to be in this community of excellence, and you may not do very much, but it should be serious, well-intentioned, and highly critical.
Robert Mallory helped expose him to a life of the mind. In gratitude, Tebow even named his daughter after his mentor.
Yes, Mallory Ann.
The fundamentals of learning and criticizing, like sports, he told Gail Eichenthal, became essential elements of his life as a painter and as a teacher. He gave up the idea of becoming a commercial artist, and he doubled down and then tripled down on his technique.
And you know that doing something once is never enough. And as Degas says, if you start drawing, be sure you draw 10 times, correct it over and over again, even 100 times, to get to that ballet slipper fitting on the shoe properly. In that instance, I think you don't think of creativity so much, because what you're doing is creating all the time. Some of it not very good, but it's a creation nonetheless. And the nerve of failure, I think, is paramount. Learning by mistakes, modifying, reconstituting, reorganizing, over and over again.
It's not unusual for Wayne Thiebaud to return to paintings years later, sometimes decades later, to rework them.
Almost always. A miracle occurs often when something happens when you almost had, you feel had nothing to do with it. It's just suddenly there. And I'm one sort of against mysteriousness about painting, but it's there somewhere. But when you think about it, painting itself is a kind of miracle, because what you're doing is reducing a three-dimensional world of living, active, organized chaos into this little, flat, unmoving, quiet, flat thing, which has to, in some ways, be able to speak to you.
But it will never be perfect.
I don't think perfection is a very interesting thing, because we are all imperfect. And that's quite wonderful, because it's what we call human.
It also leaves open the possibility, always, that the next painting will come a little closer.
Any painters that I admire and interested in are kind of always hanging on by their fingertips, hoping that the next painting will be better, or that they can finally get that vision that they have in their mind. I think it's the quest and the challenge that keeps you going. When you get to a point of where you can do something somehow that you feel you can do and you anticipate the end result, it's no longer very interesting. You've got to, I think, risk making a terrible painting or a terrible idea and see what you can do with it. And it's often disastrous. I mean, if you can get one painting out of 12 or 15, that's a very high batting average. You see, one of the problems with painters is we don't have editors like you do. And we know, and you know, how important editors are and have been. So we then have to, I think, really do move to critical confrontation in order to somehow hopefully ensure that you're not degrading your work, being repetitive, becoming a kind of art world employee, where you're expected to make these light manufacturing products. I think that's a kind of death.
The list of contemporary artists who have moved Wayne Thiebaud is topped by Willem de Kooning and Richard Diebenkorn. You can see their influence, particularly in his landscape work.
Well, there are great lessons and great influences, and I've actually stolen things from them. I do try to do what they do.
Thiebaud says his paintings also owe a great deal to Velázquez, Soutine, Manet, and Cézanne, and to Chinese tradition. In his extraordinary San Francisco cityscapes with their dizzying roller coaster streets, Thiebaud often manages to take various views of the same scene from different angles and incorporate them into a single image.
I was trying to get the feeling of equilibrium and disequilibrium, because you feel that in, I think, San Francisco. It's hard to imagine how those cars can stay on the street or buildings can suddenly thrust themselves up on a kind of what seems to be an earth mound, you know, just makes you feel this can't work. So that was very much a part, at least, of the the ideas I wanted to try to get into it. I think it has to do again with what we talked about with body empathy. It helps to enliven. What you have to do with a painting is to enliven it with your body, to feel its tensions, to feel its dislocation, or to feel its comfort. Gee, this feels really stable, for instance. On the other hand, if it's a little too stable, it can die on you. So, it's a wonderful tightrope walk.
Wayne Thiebaud had his first New York solo show in 1962 at the Allen Stone Gallery. He had sold many paintings already back home in California, but this was the event that launched his mad success. What he brought with him to New York and to his new dealer were his newer paintings, the pastries, with their vibrating rings of color and their paint frosting thick on the canvas. If you've only seen these reproduced on greeting cards and calendars, get thee to a museum. They are a whole different thing close up. Still, in 1962, there were doubts at first.
These newer paintings, they were troubling to people, and understandably so. Pies and cakes and hot dogs, those things. So Allen Stone, the dealer, was very puzzled by them, and it took him a year or two to get to a point of saying, before I got the courage to show the damn thing, the way he put it. And that's quite a mark of his ability and loyalty to take me on and see what he could do. But we really didn't have very many hopes. He said to me, I think you're a good painter. I don't know about these, but we'll show them. And we'll show them, I'll try to get a plan of about 5 to 10 years where we keep showing things of yours in the hope you gain a kind of clientele. And that's what we did. So it was a big shock to find that serendipitously pop art came in. And we were sort of shunted into that sudden, interesting world. That is to say, interesting to the critics, interesting to people. And that's how really it occurred.
I have tried my best to avoid referring to Wayne Thiebaud as an artist, but what I have really avoided calling him is a pop artist, which many people do. But as he just said, his connection to the exploding world of pop art in the 1950s and 60s was serendipitous. He was just doing his own thing, exploring the everyday objects of middle-class American life with reverie and joy, while the pop artists in New York, like Roy Lichtenstein and Andy Warhol, were approaching their subjects with detachment and tongues firmly planted in cheeks. Warhol in particular, with his Campbell soup cans and boxes of Brillo.
I had no interest at all because I thought the commercial artist was much better than he was and still feel that way. I'm a kind of heretic, I guess, but I'm not very interested in pop art.
Gaze for a while at a Wayne Thiebaud painting of donuts and you will begin to notice the blues, the pinks, and the reds, the shadows, and the halos of light that make them so enticing. These are pleasurable paintings, friendly paintings.
Well, you know, bakeries and display people are very good at making them look almost transcendent. Just like they do with diamonds. I mean, how many lights they put on them to make them sparkle so much, or used car places where they have that row of lights to light them up and make them sparkle.
And you do that too in your own way.
Yes, I hope so. What's the use of making it look bad, you know?
In most of these paintings, there is repetition. Not just one donut, but a row of donuts. Not one bow tie, but a showcase of bow ties or lollipops. Or pinball machines.
Well, it has to do with a kind of tradition of painting, of orchestrating a single shape into its various configurative potentials. If you look closely, they look all alike at first until you examine them, and each one is curiously different in some minor way. And that orchestrating principle you can find all through the tradition of, in the history of painting. And it's like a drum beat, you know. Slight variation, repetition, rhythms, and so on.
These paintings of the ordinary can, as I mentioned at the beginning, fetch unordinary prices into the millions. And that is something that, like the word artist, makes Mr. Thiebaud feel a little uncomfortable.
Puzzling and curiously unreal. Something which you never, ever would think of it ever occurring. Dangerous in the sense of over-celebration. Unreal in terms of value structure. Obviously going to change. If we look carefully, if we're interested at all, that stock market interest goes up and down like the stock market, sometimes to disastrous results for in many instances. So it's a, I think, fascinating phenomena, interesting, but very puzzling and very temporary, I think.
Maybe so, but it's not looking likely that the value of a Wayne Thiebaud painting is dropping anytime soon. And it wouldn't matter much to Mr. Thiebaud in any case. He has always lived in the same modest house in Sacramento, where he raised his family, and worked in the same modest studio, mixing colors in the plastic lids from his tennis cans, recreating in paint the most beautiful things in his life.
I can't take any credit for any theoretical or philosophical awareness of it, but it was somehow important to me to be honest in what we do and to love what it is we paint. These were lessons given to me by other artists, obviously. To do what you love or are interested in or have some regard for. And it seems to me that it's easy to overlook what we spend our majority of time doing, and that's an intimate association with everyday things. Putting on our shoes, tying our ties, eating our breakfast, cooking our meals, washing our dishes. And somehow that ongoing human activity seems to me very much worth doing. It's only when we become presumptive, I think, to think we're better than that and would like to be and should think of ourselves being better, that we begin to ignore those things. But in a wonderful way, children re-remind us of it. They go to the gumball machines with a little penny and put it in and say, "Look, Dad, look what came out of this terrible looking thing. This magenta, sweet little world of wonder." And that to me is as good as we get.
His favorite pie to eat, by the way, lemon meringue. That's painter Wayne Thiebaud, who turns 100 on November 15th, 2020. The Crocker Museum in Sacramento, California, is currently running an exhibition called Wayne Thiebaud 100, Paintings, Prints, and Drawings. And now, to honor Mr. Thiebaud's legacy as a teacher and a mentor to other artists, we'll hear from one of his many students who changed the art world, Fritz Schulder. Scholder became the most famous, most influential, and most controversial figure in modern Native American art. He was born in Minnesota, but in 1957, he moved with his family to Sacramento and enrolled in college, which is where he met Wayne Thiebaud. Thiebaud introduced Scholder to the bold brushstrokes and the bright colors we've been talking about. He introduced him to abstract expressionism and postmodernism, both of which figure prominently in Scholder's portraits of American Indians. Those portraits are not the whole body of Fritz Scholder's work, but they are what made him most famous, and they help bring about a revolution in Native art. But it takes some digging to try to understand, because Scholder never considered himself an Indian artist, despite some Indian ancestry. More on that in a moment. Scholder died in 2005 at the age of 67, but his interview with the Academy of Achievement, recorded in 1996, is in the Academy's archive.
I sold my first painting in grade school to a friend of mine for $4. And I sold my second painting to a grade school buddy for $5 and slowly worked up from there.
Fritz Scholder said art was his safe haven when he was a child. He was painfully shy and spent most of his time alone in his room drawing so that he wouldn't have to deal with people. There was never a question in his mind that he would become an artist. It was all he felt he could do. But in the 1940s, the path wasn't so clear.
You had to realize that at times art was really pretty foreign. For most people, an artist meant going to Paris and starving in a garret. No one was making a living in this country except for Georgia and Thomas Hart.
That's Georgia O'Keeffe and Thomas Hart.
And so what one did was to get degrees and teach at a university, and if you were good, you might be able to get an artist in residency. So it was pretty bleak to think that you could be an artist, although I, right from the beginning, identified as that, and won my first prize in fourth grade. I did finally accidentally bump into a professional artist, quotations, an Indian artist, Oscar Howe, in Pierce, South Dakota, and a full-blooded Sioux who had gone to Europe because of the war, found out about modern art quotations, and it really messed up his mind in a way, but he did come away doing Indian subjects in a Cubist style.
Pierce, South Dakota is where Fritz Scholder's family lived when he was in high school. His teacher, Oscar Howe, wasn't much of a teacher. He taught by doing, which meant in practice that he'd just go off into the corner of the classroom and paint while the students watched. Fritz Scholder watched carefully. His other early influences were the Impressionists, mostly. Picasso, Matisse, Bonnard. Later, he would come under the spell of Francis Bacon, and later still, of course, Wayne Thiebaud.
Early on, for some reason, I realized that I did not want to live like others. And I saw people go to jobs they hated, come home, and not be happy. I had a problem with authority, so I knew that I couldn't have an 8-to-5 job with a boss. But it came early on to me that by being an artist, I would have the most freedom, because an artist not only has to make up his own problem, but then solve it in whatever way he decides to do that. And it's all up to him. Now, that might sound scary, but for me, it was a great release to know that one could do that. Now, you might have to live in a frugal way at that time. Very few lived off their art. But I was ready for that, and I also learned to talk well, to communicate, because most artists became teachers, and I got all my degrees to teach, and I love teaching. I love to turn people on to new ideas, but by the time I got through the college experience, art had become in this country. It was the 1950s, and abstract expressionism had exploded onto the New York art scene. And to me, it was so interesting to see the many different styles that are viable in painting. And painting is my my first love. I also am a sculptor and printmaker and bookmaker and all kinds of things now. But painting was what I really wanted to do.
Then life took an unexpected turn. He was invited to participate in the Rockefeller Indian Art Project at the University of Arizona in 1961, and then to teach at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. The thing is, though, Fritz Scholder maintained through his life that he was not Indian. His father was one half Luseño. The Luseño are an indigenous people of Southern California, a tribe whose members were brought into the missions to work and to be schooled. Scholder's father attended Indian schools, which the U.S. government funded in an effort to assimilate Indians, in other words, make them white. And his father, in fact, became ashamed of his heritage, and he chose to live as a white man, marry a white woman, and raise his children to be white. But as Fritz Scholder grew as an artist, his relationship with his own Indianness became complicated.
Today in our society, everyone has to contend with the media, in which they like to immediately pigeonhole you and say, oh, this is an expressionist. Oh, this is this type of artist or dancer, whatever. And it's a constant fight. All artists find that they have to fight against what they become known for. My teacher, Wayne Thiebaud, was mislabeled a pop artist when he started painting pies and cakes. Wayne was not interested in the pop movement. He was a historian who had seen the edibles on the tabletop of Manet and took it from that. So often, popular media will pounce on something and not be accurate, but you're stuck with it, usually forever, because hardly do they come back and do a update. So I was mislabeled an Indian artist because I had done a series on the American Indian when I came to Santa Fe. It was a very natural thing because all painters who go to Santa Fe become immediately seduced by this very strange and foreign little town who still thinks about how much Indian blood someone has. Well, I never thought about it because I grew up in public schools and I'm not an Indian. I'm very proud of being one quarter Luseño, which is California Mission, but I just never had that background.
But living in Santa Fe, getting to know Native American culture and the efforts to annihilate it, Fritz Scholder got woke.
Well, this was all foreign to me. When I got on the faculty of a National Indian Arts School for 5 years, it was my one and only job. I resigned because I knew I had to really get going on painting. But I did find out about that element, which is a very strange factor in our whole makeup today, when you realize that here's the supposedly most sophisticated country that still has wards, human beings who don't have full rights. Now, you don't have to live on the reservation, but if you do, some of your rights are gone. And plus, the government has had the worst history for trying to deal with the Indian. At first, they tried to make him white, and that failed, and now they don't know what to do because they lost. But I really was had a very unique position in Santa Fe and elsewhere because people didn't know what to do with me. I look more Indian than I am, but the thing is, I have a perspective that transcends any of this current history, and it is current. And you can't blame them for still not believing the white man. But that's a whole different thing. I don't believe that art and politics mix. But the artist must be, I think, must have something to say about whatever subject, because every subject is a cliche. We all are so sophisticated, and especially visually. We've seen thousands of apples or women or cats or dogs. And so the challenge to the painter is great to still come up with something different.
He had always sworn he would not make paintings of Indians, as so many other Santa Fe artists did. But then he changed his tune in 1967 when he realized, inspired by the experimentalism of his own students, that he could paint Indians in an entirely new way. Not in the traditional manner of Indian artists, not in the mythologized, sentimental manner of white artists. He would make paintings of real Indian people, some expressing outrage and strength, some wrapped in the patriotism of an American flag, some affected by the scourge of alcoholism, and some just eating ice cream. But he would render them in wild colors and in the style of abstract expressionism. When those paintings were shown at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian in 2008, the exhibition was titled Fritz Scholder, Indian, Not Indian, which pretty much sums it up. Much about Scholder is confounding, but what's perfectly clear is that he shifted the ground for a whole generation of artists who are Native American. After he stopped painting his Indian portraits in 1980, he turned to other subjects, including vampires and mythology. He was, I think it's fair to say, a bit of an eccentric who worked at breakneck speed and produced a lot.
Part of the creative process, everyone works differently, but I believe in rituals. I believe in certain things that you find out about yourself that makes you do things the way you like. I walk into the studio and I'm like Pavlov's dog. I don't go in every day. It's very special still. If I had to go into the studio every day, it'd be like a job, which is a bad word for me. So I walk in and I turn on the music I like. And I wander around as if I've never been in a studio. And I now have the luxury of having beautiful canvases waiting for me, every size I would want. Beautiful handmade papers with my signature in the watermark. I mean, it's very luxury to have nice materials, and yet, on the other hand, people can get really so involved with materials. Any paper will do. Any old stick. I did a children's book recently where I did all the drawings with a stick and ink because I wanted to show that they can do those. They were symbols. Kids love symbols, ancient symbols, runic symbols. It's the material isn't really as important as what you do with it. Lautrec would stumble out in the alleyway after he woke up every morning and find a piece of old cardboard and do the most beautiful painting. Now, true, French cardboard is a little nicer than United States cardboard, but the thing is, what I'm saying, found objects, anything can work, it's how you do it. Picasso took a bicycle seat and made a great sculpture, of course.
Fritz Scholder was extremely successful as an artist, but he was committed to the idealism of art, unadulterated by commerce.
You have to try to keep your art pure and not go into advertising, not go into commercial art, because that's a whole different deal. A fine artist must do exactly what he wants to do, with no pressure. Whether it's from your parents, your girlfriend, your wife, you must block all that out. Fine art, if it's the highest form of human expression, means self-integrity. And when you're in that studio, you must do whatever you do completely for yourself. And you must be your own worst critic, which means that after you've done it, you must live with it, decide if it should leave the studio. Often, I destroy the work either at the moment or right after I've done it, or days later or years later. I still will go in the studio at night and destroy paintings because they're mine.
As his teacher Wayne Thiebaud said, the greatest painting an artist will ever make is always the one he or she will make tomorrow.
Painting is a very much a maturing process. this is nice because at the end of your life, you can be doing your best work. And Hokusai, the great painter on his deathbed at 102, said, if I could only have one more day, I could do a great painting. I am fascinated with every single day. In fact, I say something, often aloud, when I wake up that may be embarrassing to some. I don't know. I read it from Charles Bukowski, down and out poet. And he had this one poem, I remember, or part of a poem, in which he said, have you just woken up 3 o'clock in the morning in a hotel room in Detroit looking for a cigarette? Another good day. And I always wake up and say, another good day. I believe that one is a different person with every day. I believe that you should have adventures, new adventures every day. Meet new people, bring in new information. If you don't, you're being bad to yourself. And I don't believe in excuses. Any crying around, either do it or don't. Because we only have that day. We only have, of course, the moment. And so it's completely up to us to decide what to do with ourselves.
And each day, the only thing Fritz Schulder ever found really worth doing was making art.
Fine art is still the best racket around in that it is simply the basic human activity without machines, without others, of going, walking up to a canvas by yourself and directly with a brain telling your hand what you want to do, making a mark. And it doesn't matter what that mark looks like. If you have to make that mark, if you have the integrity, the audacity to try for the greatest luxury that a human being has of doing exactly what you want to do when you want to do it and not care what anyone thinks, and being able to stand next to that painting when it's done and saying, I did this, knowing that some people will laugh, some people criticize, but some people might be on your wavelength. And then you put it out there.
That's Fritz Schulder, painter, sculptor, bookmaker, and former student of today's other celebrated guest, Wayne Thiebaud. We sign off today by sending our very best wishes to Mr. Thiebaud on his 100th birthday. Long may he paint. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. Take a listen to some of our other episodes about artists, including Maya Lin and Chuck Jones. What It Takes is generously funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.